So hello and welcome to our Tip of the Iceberg podcast. We're talking about extreme heat. This is based on a report that came out from the IMECE in April, which is entitled Adapting Industry to Withstanding Rising Temperatures and Future Heat Waves. It's pretty interesting stroke scary reading that actually gives a lot of compelling evidence about temperatures already rising and the impact that has on the buildings and processes and the people working and living within the UK. It also makes a lot of recommendations around what we should be doing to adapt to these changes. I'm talking about businesses doing climate risk assessments, having long-term adaptation strategies, and changes in design codes and practices. So I've got together a range of members of the Institute to talk about these issues and really try to tease this apart and find out in a little bit more detail what this could mean for members of the Institute of Refrigeration and for the refrigeration air conditioning community in general. So I'll ask everyone to introduce themselves and say a little bit about who they are and why they're involved in the Institute. So let's start with Rob Lamb.
Thanks, Miriam. Yes, I'm Rob Lamb. I'm Group Sales and Marketing Director for Star Refrigeration. I joined the industry 25 years ago with Star, and I've been a member pretty much all that time. When I joined, it was really to keep up on my CPD and to learn more about the industry. But over time, I've had the privilege to also input into various committees and various works that the IOR has done.
Thanks, Rob. Chris.
Thanks, Miriam. Hi, everyone. I'm Chris Green, Engineering Director for the Heat Pump Solutions team here at Vital Energy. However, a lot of my experiences relating to this context of this podcast are from my former role as Engineering Director at Arctic Circle, where I worked for close to 25 years. I'm a member of the Institute, as I find it's a gateway to sort of world-class guidance and literature, along with the big opportunity to network with like-minded individuals who are all committed to supporting this fascinating industry.
Thanks, Chris. And Brian.
Hi, Brian Churchyard, Managing Director of Amiga Solutions. I've been involved in the industry for many years, from the outset of being a refrigeration apprentice all the way up to the dizzy heights of MD of Amiga Solutions, as I said. I'm a fellow of the Institute of Refrigeration, and with it being a lifelong career, very passionate about being involved, staying involved, and helping support to be part of the solution and part of the discussion and ongoing learnings.
Great. Thank you all very much. Because it gives an idea of the type of different roles that people are involved in within the Institute and also the work that they're doing. So I do want to go around again and ask you what you think, having read the report, or in terms of your awareness of the impact of extreme heat in the businesses that you're involved in, you know, what's the big takeaway, the big message? Is this new, or did you know it all already?
In terms of the point that you just mentioned there, you know, is it something that we knew already? Well, you know, we've seen temperatures creeping up. You know, you only have to look back when we look back on projects that we did 20, 25 years ago, where we had design ambience of 30 degrees or less. More recently, you know, we've been working around the 35, but I think this whole report raises a very strong and good point in the fact that we have to stop looking backwards in terms of what we're doing in design principles and start looking forwards. You know, you don't drive a car by looking in the rearview mirror, you look out the front. And, you know, what the front window is showing is that the temperatures are going up, and we need to be prepared for that, both in terms of actual equipment's ability to deliver cooling, but also in relation to the whole aspect of sustainability and energy efficiency in relation to that as well. You know, so we have to be prepared. And I think that's the big takeaway that I saw from the report. It was that whole idea of looking forwards and planning for the future rather than using old data, old information around ambient temperatures and old design strategies and policies that people have used in the past.
Everyone, you know, has always thought, well, climate change is a long way off, but it suddenly seems to be right in front of our noses right now. And that's where they're talking about people having to think about what changes they want to make now.
Yeah, I think 40 degrees last summer suddenly got everybody's attention, didn't it? You know, and the challenges that led to within our sector in particular, trying to cope with those high ambience that we hadn't seen before.
Chris, anything from your point of view?
Just to echo a lot of Rob's sentiments, really. So I found the report to be really eye-opening. While the topic isn't particularly brand new. I remember as an apprentice aged maybe 17 years old, being involved in a retrofit project to replace fans on air-cooled condensing units to cope with the increase in ambient temperatures. And I'm clearly aware of the global mean temperature across the world being above the pre-industrial levels. But I think the report highlighted a few things. I think the combination of some case studies, the direct experiences from a number of different countries, and then also the direct experience that we faced here in the UK across the last couple of years, really hit home the magnitude of the challenge that we're facing here.
Because often it feels as though it's somebody else's responsibility. It's just too big. We just have to carry on as normal. And I think that's what they're trying to say, is things have to change.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, one of the points that Rob mentioned in the report is that I think we need to start focusing more on what's coming rather than what's happened in the past. And this is perhaps where, yeah, some changes need to happen with either guidance documents or perhaps with standards as well.
And Brian, your thoughts, you know, with your experience, particularly in retail, I would think that most of those businesses are aware of some of the challenges. But do you think that the report focuses in a little bit more on that?
Yeah, we've been aware and known that the reports has been coming, the review's been coming for some time now. But it's the outputs and the impacts of these things. When you look at the design standards of systems going back to the 80s, I mean, 80s and 90s, certainly in food retail, there are still systems out there that are operating to a design condition. So Rob's point that he made right at the beginning, that some instances are operating to a maximum design condition of 28 degrees Celsius. In some instances, you'll find some supermarkets even lower than that. But that is going back to the 80s, early 90s. You see then an increase in design standards through the 90s, then more recently going to the 90s, you know, the 2020s, where I'd left a previous role that I'd had as a head of engineering for one of the large supermarkets, so having to lift that design standard again. So if you look at it over the last 25 years, we've already been doing it. We've already been seeing the impact of warmer climates. Even if you go back to, like I say, the early 90s, 28 degrees Celsius, then to 32, and then more recently to 35. So action has been taken previously, but it's more from a end user specific perspective rather than it being necessarily an industry guidance kind of recognition to make sure that those design standards are increased. I guess the end users are always going to be very interested in it because it has a significant impact on the ability to sell calories to the public. Non-operational refrigeration, chilled and frozen equipment is a useless asset at the end of the day. And keeping up with the design conditions and making sure that you are selecting technology that is actually built to be resilient in higher ambient conditions, whether it's the type of technology you're selecting or the design conditions to which you're working to, becoming ever so important. And we're not to forget food waste when we talk specifically about refrigeration, because the increased need of additional refrigeration to a higher design standard, consuming more energy, and non-operational failing systems also results. If you haven't got any resilience in your system, results ultimately not just a loss in sales, but also a significant lost impact to food waste, which we never talk about.
That is something the report brings out as well. It's not just food, because it's looking at everything. It's talking about industrial processing, where systems might fall down, systems that are critical in terms of pharmaceuticals and things like that as well. So not just the retail side, which I think, you know, everybody's going to be aware of the need to have fresh food or see fresh food in supermarkets, but you're actually going even further back into whether they can keep that food fresh at the food processing side of it, but then also say the non-food related. Rob, a lot of your work is on the industrial side. Are those businesses doing the risk assessments that they need to do to make sure that those critical operations will be maintained in extreme heat events?
There's certainly been a greater focus on that, I would say, in the last 2 to 3 years. I think as the noise has got greater around a warming global temperature, people have become more concerned. We've had a few hot summers recently, so I've seen a number of customers ask us now for a 40-degree design point. And some of that is down to the growing ambient temperature. A lot of that is actually related to issues they've already having around things like air recirculation, poor air movement, and sometimes also, you know, the way the things are designed and maintained, which is leading to elevated condensing temperatures. I think it's something that more and more people are starting to ask for. Benefit now is that if you design for that future point between now and when that actually becomes more of the norm, you can potentially gain some benefits in terms of efficiency and performance and greater reliability, that you're not going into the summer biting your nails thinking, am I going to survive this next hot day that's coming along? You actually buy yourself that time and that opportunity. And when energy costs are high, you can actually obviously reduce your running costs as we can operate below that peak point.
Is this all about the new systems? It's important to clarify, you know, are we talking about new systems going in and customers refurbishing? What about the existing systems? We've got to think about the majority of systems, as you were saying earlier, Brian, that they're in there for 10 years or something like that. So they may be designed for very different operating conditions. Often with these kind of reports and discussions, they talk about innovation and looking to the future, and we can get more efficient systems and get a better cooling. But what about the existing stock?
There are things that can be done in terms of retrofits, for example. You know, when you are coming to a point where you're replacing equipment, upgrade it for something that is going to take you into the future. And it doesn't necessarily mean replacing the whole system, but replacing things like condensers that give you that extra reach, extra surface, then that can give you some benefits in relation to that, and taking those steps now to prepare for it.
Yes, it's a huge challenge. I mean, the forward focus on technology, system design, new system installation is always kind of, I guess it's not easy, but it's easier than trying to deal with your existing systems, because the cost to transition this equipment is just enormous for the user, whoever it might be. And if we're then asking those users to build in additional cost to what is already quite a significant investment for them to make their systems more resilient, that becomes a real challenge for them because of the affordability of the technology. You know, refrigeration, heating, cooling buildings, chilling, freezing products doesn't come cheap. And if we're having to increase the design standard for even further, that will come at an additional cost. And we have to talk about cost. You know, the affordability is a real challenge. So what can we do to, you know, try and mitigate some of that cost impact? More efficient systems. I mean, energy efficiency is absolutely critically important. You know, we can't be having a situation where we're saying on one hand that ambient temperatures are increasing year on year. There's going to be an impact on energy consumption by default because those ambients are going up. And also, by the way, the cost of the equipment is going to increase even further. So where does innovation come in? Where does it step in? How do we mitigate some of those challenges around energy and cost? Very much a case of that saying of have your cake and eat it. But that's where we are. We've got to do that. We can't be facing into going, well, we need more refrigeration equipment. It's going to cost us more money and it's going to take more energy. Or do we think differently about it? I mean, you'll seeing again back into the food retail world are investing in things like doors on refrigerated display cases. Huge energy benefit, but also reduces the amount of refrigeration plants you need by up to 40-50%. These are decisions that are having to be made that would not even be thought of 5-10 years ago. Quite, it requires end users to think differently. When you look backwards, becoming more of a challenge, a smaller investment in things like, say, adiabatic cooling systems, you know, that have with the right design and more importantly, the right service and maintenance of those systems over the extension of their life, can go a long way to supporting those older systems that are really designed for a different condition altogether. Then you've got the challenge of cooling buildings. Buildings that are uncomfortable all of a sudden become a real challenge, not just uncomfortable, but the equipment inside them equally starts to be impacted quite significantly. So just, you know, going for an integral type solution, which is just installed to a building because it's an easy option, is going to cause you even more pain in the future if you're not appropriately cooling those spaces and cooling those buildings for the systems to operate. So I think in summary to the question, you have to think about your existing estate, not just the cost to replace that equipment, but what options have I got, the lower cost options to keep the systems operational through those conditions, with equally understanding what you need to do from a new installation, new design perspective. You've got to look at the entire thing in order to be successful with it.
I think there's a good point there as well, around, you know, looking taking a step back, because the refrigeration does its job to remove heat that's going into a building. It doesn't create that heat that's going into that building. And therefore, thinking about it, there are aspects that you can do around what the building is like. So, you know, for example, just in recent months, visiting a facility that was actually a non-food facility, but they had a breakdown of their building insulation, which was leading to considerable heat gain through the building, and therefore was something around the building material that reduces the heat load. So look at the building, take that step back, you know, where is the heat coming from and why is it needing to be extracted? So taking that view, you don't have to start with your refrigeration. Your refrigeration is almost the last place to go to. Try and deal with the building, then look at how you operate the building. You know, are there things that you can put in place? I remember doing various works with retailers on distribution warehouses. Keeping the door shut is the key one, and fitting the right trucks to the right door so you haven't got big gaping holes in the middle of summer with warm air pouring in. That's where the big loads are. So a mixture of how the building is actually constructed and how it's looking now after 5, 10, 20 years of operation, and then how you operate. Are there things that can be done in operation of the building to reduce the amount of cooling that is needed? And then moving on to the refrigeration. Now, you can do all those three things in parallel, but actually stopping the heat at source through the building materials, through the building construction, you can count that on existing buildings, looking at the state of the fabric, looking how it's operated, and can you actually change some of those points to reduce the load?
In the report, there's talking about the fact that the buildings are not designed to dissipate the heat, that those buildings are absorbing the external heat. So I guess the kind of question that's coming out of that is, to what extent is our refrigeration industry working with building designers to make the whole building resilient? Or are they just building and popping a bit of refrigeration in? Is that one of our solutions? Because we talked about new ways of working, having to prepare now for challenges ahead. Are people working together on these issues? Or are they still working in silos?
I've seen a greater use of things like better insulation. You know, the thicknesses of insulation used for construction of buildings now has improved over a number of years. There's been better doors design, loading doors and things like that for warehouses to improve matters from that point of view. Things like data centers, they've increased the operating temperature and the equipment's ability to deal with higher temperatures within the facility to reduce the reliance on cooling, for example. So steps are being taken to do that. I think the other aspect, purely from a refrigeration point of view, is we're often the forgotten bit. So, you know, you often see a refrigeration plant sat on the south facing wall or on the roof where it's baking in the sun all day long rather than in the north face shadow, where it actually benefits from quite a few degrees of cooling because it's not sat in the sun all day long. So there is plenty of work, I think, that can be done in terms of bringing those disciplines together in order to improve that situation, because I think often the refrigeration is sort of a secondary thought when constructing a building. A lot of it's focused on the land and on the structural design and things like that. And then the fridge bit just keeps it cool. So yeah, getting in those early discussions around what some of the better things are to do in terms of the fabric of the building, how the building operates, what type of cooling, where it's located, et cetera, is going to be crucial. We can certainly improve that.
In the report itself, there isn't that much on refrigeration, really. There is a little bit about heat recovery. There is certainly stuff about industrial processes that use cooling that could fail, but it doesn't go in too much into it. Although the case studies, there's some heat recovery, heat pumps and things like that. We talked about various innovations. Chris, from your background in manufacturing, do you see the innovations coming forward that are going to solve this problem or at least provide some solutions?
I think there's some fairly basic innovation being used to try and combat either retrofit solutions. Brian mentioned adiabatic cooling for condensers and gas coolers in the warmer months. And they're becoming more and more widespread across the industry now. I'm not certain that the unintended consequences are fully considered with regards to the potential reduction in life expectancy if those systems are poorly maintained or poorly installed. With regards to new equipment, it's tricky. I think there's a big opportunity for thermal storage, both sensible and latent thermal storage, to try and reduce the peak loading on a system for both heating and cooling. And I feel that's an area where the RIC HP sector has perhaps not fully explored yet.
And we talked about design envelopes. So just changing the way you design rather than incremental energy efficiency, it looks to be really a major change of ways of working if you are talking about long-term planning, which is something that often customers do struggle with because they're looking at the lowest immediate cost rather than long-term. And looking at climate as a risk really hasn't been on the agenda, I don't think, quite so much before.
With energy prices, though, as they are, the total cost of ownership side of things comes into play here, because Brian's right. You know, the initial capital cost goes up. It costs people a lot of money to invest in this larger equipment to deal with these extremes. But when you start to then take into account the benefit of being able to actually use that larger equipment to give you better efficiencies going into the future, and when you take into consideration the improvement in reliability and operational uptime, then all of those things should really counter that point around initial capital cost. You know, the cost of having cabinets down in a store or a warehouse down or a data center down for hours is significant. And when you compare that to the additional capital cost, it's a very strong argument to make that initial investment. It's just getting that message across in a way that people can understand.
So we've noticed recently that the Environmental Audit Committee is setting up, the House of Commons Environmental Audit Committee is setting up an inquiry about how can we learn to live with rising temperatures in the UK. So what opportunities do you think this provides to influence policy? You know, what's needed to get everyone to make those decisions based on better technologies or more resilient equipment and not just carry on with business as usual? And if you had something to say to that inquiry, what would your recommendations be?
These are always difficult questions to try and have a view on and an answer as to. I think some of it goes back to the point previously about design collaboration, that definitely what Rob was saying in terms of, if you look at a new building design, the amount of meetings that I've been in over my career where refrigeration is just, even some instances, has not even been considered from an architectural perspective, that it's just, we'll give you a space. And even if a space is allocated to it, it for some reason, it becomes this kind of this afterthought or not even thought at all, which I always find very strange when you consider how critically important it is to some of these operations. To your point you made right at the beginning, Miriam, about pharmaceutical industry, the industrial industry. I mean, if these units go down, the impacts and the cost impacts to business is just phenomenal. So there needs to be, from the building regulation standards, rather than just seeing refrigeration as a process, that actually needs to be thought of intrinsically within the building design, you know, in the same way that heating and cooling of the building is thought about up front. If you are using refrigeration as a process within that building, it needs to be thought of in tandem. And that's all very well from a new building perspective. Also, when you're looking back at the existing estates, some of these organizations have huge property portfolios that are using building, heating, cooling, refrigeration extensively when you look at the existing estate as well as the new build. So I think it's, how do you drive a collaborative design approach across the different sectors to get to a point where everything is thought about up front and not just an afterthought?
It's a challenge, yet another challenge.
It's a huge challenge. We've had this problem for as long as anybody can ever remember being involved in the industry, but it's becoming more prevalent now than ever before.
Again, the report really shows that we're coming to that crisis point of how much extra it costs. Capital costs increased 50% and energy 100% for each 5 degrees in temperature. So it's becoming evidenced that the issues are real.
Well, I think just on that point, that really plays into the point around energy efficiency and actually investing in the right equipment to give you a reduced amount of energy consumption, because over the life, the energy is going to be dominant in terms of the overall cost. It's a different model of how you actually procure stuff. You know, it's a model that has been used, but it's all too easy to go back to the capital cost and what's the cheapest capital cost, because that's the bit that's there and staring you in the face straight away. But yeah, getting that collaboration in terms of the building the layout, its orientation, where the equipment sits, the type of materials that are used. They're the things that we've got to get into to conversations earlier. You know, going back to Brian's point, I've been sat in meetings before and spent more time discussing the lighting in the car park than we have about the refrigeration plant that's keeping the place operating, you know, because we're just so far down the agenda. And the fact, as you say in the report, it is seen as a secondary point, you know, it's way down there. But it's right in some ways, and we've got to get the building right. But we can help provide some knowledge and experience about what helps from a cooling perspective if sat around that table and having those discussions rather than being bought in once that's all sorted out. And we've just then got to deliver the cooling to the building that's already been planned. So yeah, getting ourselves a bit further in the queue would do no harm at all in terms of improving and dealing with this particular issue.
Yeah, well, it comes back to their points about having climate strategies and risk assessments in place, because if you look at it from that point of view, your cooling system is actually more important than your car park lighting, perhaps. One of the points they do make in the report that is a really interesting one, like we talk in the Institute and with our members about efficiency and really efficient technologies and new technologies all the time. And so we're trying to reduce our carbon footprint and the emissions from our sector. It's very clear that the demand for cooling is going to increase. You know, you've got to increase the capacity, but also have more cooling in more different areas, and buildings being one of the points where, you know, it's not just about, they used to call it comfort cooling. It's not about comfort cooling so much now. It's about welfare of people. You know, if the temperature gets too hot, there's some guidelines somewhere, I'm sure, that says you shouldn't be working at a certain temperature. And it also has those health impacts. They've done that research as well about working in hotter environments can have impact on public health. They talk about having cool shelters and things like that nowadays. So it's all sorts of different buildings. So there were questions there about whether the industry can cope with an increased demand. Will there be enough equipment? Will there not be enough spares? Will there be enough people? We want to reduce our emissions at the same time as increasing the amount of cooling generated.
I think one thing's clear, the capital cost will increase over the coming years. And in doing so, it highlights the importance of selecting energy efficient products. Because if one thing is guaranteed is you're going to have to invest in an increased capital, then this is the time to identify those energy saving measures. Because if you don't, all that's going to happen is you'll suffer the penalty of not only the capital cost increase, but also the significant energy cost increase as well.
And also your emissions increase, I guess, if you don't, you know, if you know the demand is going to increase and you don't get those savings straight off, you're going to blow your sustainability budgets, right?
Absolutely.
So we've had issues around energy efficiency and capital. Do you think the industry can cope with the increasing demand? Because yes, everybody, you know, everyone's in business. So having more demand for your business is seen to be a good thing, provided the equipment is available. Do you think we are gearing up, that we're ready, or are there other issues there outside our control?
There's certainly a concerted effort by the industry to upskill and train, because, you know, with the advent of things like F-gas certainly in Europe, and then versions of the same around the world, the technology that's been applied is only going to get more complex, cooling and heating technology. And the industry is trying its hardest to do what it needs to do to try and get the right resources, skills, knowledge, and experience in place. I fear that the interest in what we do, all of us sat around this table, is just not there, in all honesty. I think we live in a very difficult time in terms of getting the right resource in place, the new engineers in place, whether you're a design, installation, service, or maintenance engineer. Is a massive challenge. There was a clean cooling congress run by Bayes a couple of years ago, and there was a delegate over from India at that conference, and they were talking about the need to set up a cold chain in India, which is just, you can imagine the size and the task of doing something like that. It's like 70% of farm to fork product that requires cooling doesn't make it to fork, because there isn't a cold chain in place. So you've got these huge markets have got this demand for cooling, you know, refrigeration specific, which have never been there before. A growing population, a population that's becoming wealthier, a requirement for more calories to be on the table and to get that to the end user and ultimately the customer. And something like 6 pieces of cooling equipment are being sold every second around the world at the moment. So the demand of that is just off the scale, and you need skilled engineers to be able to deal with this. Refrigeration, for all intents and purposes, is a fairly complex technology and is getting more complex for one reason or another. So there is a very, there's a huge challenge on skill base out there at the moment. You also have, if you look at the UK specific, significant increase in years to come in the heat pump market. So your gas engineers turning into heat pump engineers, and that's going to have a significant draw on the commercial refrigeration trade, which is going to be a much smaller market than the heat pump market. So where are all these skilled individuals coming from? So there's the requirement and the need versus the ability to resource it and deliver. And that's outside of what it would cost. And is there enough equipment available and so on and so forth? So we've got a lot of questions that need to be answered, but that's at the same time, it's an opportunity. It's a huge opportunity for any business or organization to get out there and start figuring out how we're going to rise to the challenge, so to speak.
But a lot of the training so far has been really focused on refrigerants and changing refrigerants, and much less so on this sort of issue. And again, in the report, they do talk about more engineers, chartered engineers having, and the training courses that they're doing, being aware of climate change as a major part of that, which it currently is, and wanting to include that in CPDs and things like that. But from our point of view, we're looking also at the maintenance and service going beyond just changing out a refrigerant or understanding the differences. It's much more about how that system fits within the building and the context of the risks and climate. So there is an awful lot more to add in, it sounds like.
I think it goes on to that point earlier about reducing the demand for cooling within the buildings, reducing the demand in terms of how we operate the buildings. And I mentioned data centers earlier, you know, data centers, the processors within data centers have been able now to, are now able to operate at much higher air temperatures than they were in the past. That's just an example of where an industry has adapted to reduce its demand on energy. They can now use far more ambient cooling for large portions of the year. Now, if we take that sort of idea and move it around different sectors, what is it that we can do? Because the seesaw isn't going to balance. If what you're trying to do is drive up in the demand for cooling, that's going to drive up the demand for energy. So we have to look at how we design and operate buildings in a different way to see where are the opportunities to reduce the requirement for cooling, whether that be based upon temperature or way that things are operated. And there's this technology outside of refrigeration. You know, the chip example is, you know, computer chip example is one of them, and the processing side of it is where you can do that. And it's working in collaboration with areas outside of our own industry as well to say, well, what can we do and what can we do better? You know, Brian mentioned about the doors on refrigeration cabinets, and that's been a no-brainer for years, but was a difficult one because it was hard to sell the product when it was behind a door. But it was always there in terms of a big win in terms of saving energy. And thankfully, it's now being done, you know, across a wide number of retailers. So that's just an example in that area. But there must be dozens of those if we actually look across different areas and we look at ways to reducing that demand, because we aren't going to get that seesaw to balance otherwise, whether it be engineers, whether it be the actual energy that's required to run these systems, whether it's materials that we're digging out the ground to make them. You know, we will have to find a balance, and looking at the demand for that cooling and reducing that demand is going to be key to that. Yeah.
It appeals to me, the idea that the job of the refrigeration industry is to design out refrigeration, is to not use refrigeration, because yeah, it's kind of counterintuitive. But these are the kind of, you need more innovative solutions to address these kinds of problems. It's all that idea of not just doing the same thing, but finding, I don't know, things like tree shading, whatever, might help reduce the need for cooling. Who knows? There might be other stuff out there. We're going to have to come up with some creative solutions, perhaps.
I think it'll be a real challenge for the industry because, as Brian mentioned, the electrification of heat, as we reduce our dependency on fossil fuel, will dilute the skill set of service and maintenance engineers across the estate as they either move from refrigeration and air conditioning or towards heat pumps, or perhaps just diversify into that trade as well. And I see that from a manufacturing perspective, the requirement for new equipment, whether that's for increased cooling capacity equipment for air conditioning or comfort cooling, plus heat pumps, will certainly stretch and test the capability of the industry. It certainly highlights the requirement for collaboration. And I think with any complex challenge, the key to success is to collaborate with as wide a group of individuals as you can.
One of the things that we had talked about previous to this, when we first started putting the podcast idea together, we were talking about the role of maintenance, because designing and recommissioning is one thing. Do you think that maintenance of course, maintenance is important for reliability and good functioning, but would that be enough, or is it all about design or recommissioning?
Circular economy, where you've also got those challenges around anything that we design, install, needs to be thought about repair, not replace. You know, if you're looking at new systems going forward, so the requirement to service and maintain, keep existing systems operational for an extended period of time to kind of fit into that circular economy approach is going to become more and more prevalent. Engineers that are going to be in that service and maintenance sector, whatever they're looking at, are actually working on equipment that needs to be there for the foreseeable future. And that should be the aim and the challenge. You know, the idea of end of life at 10 years, end of life at 15 years, it probably will change in years to come in terms of talking about how a system can continually be refreshed and updated in terms of the key components that are already within it, to limit the need to do full replacements. Certainly something I've been trying to work towards, you know, in my previous life working for a large end user, is how do we realize the full asset of equipment and only replace parts of the equipment that need to be replaced as and when they absolutely need to be done, rather than replacing entire systems in one foul swoop, and being pretty successful at doing it. But it's challenging to see where other areas and other sectors are doing similar types of things in terms of really seeing that equipment, you know, come to its end of life, or like I say, even beyond end of life where it's still operational. So these huge challenges that we're facing around not just design, energy, capacity, but how do we build in that circular economy to anything that's going in the future? And the role of the service guys become more important.
Presumably some of the government incentives are more focused around new technologies, because it's easier to say, well, this one is more efficient than that. It's innovative. You can prove it. So there might be less government incentives for refurbishing existing systems. Would that be a fair thing to say?
I think it falls in the same category, doesn't it? The new is usually the easier to deal with rather than the existing. The problem is the existing dwarfs anything in terms of new installation. So is it in the too hard to do box, which is kind of not where we're at? We need to consider everything as we go through it. In terms of, like I say, circular economy, you know, you build in the design capability of new systems where it does kind of go into that repair, not replace category. But you've got the existing equipment that you're having to deal with at the same time. Yeah, it's just a big challenge all around.
I think the whole issue of maintenance as well, it's the definition of maintenance. I would define maintenance as maintaining the plant in the conditions, the design conditions it was designed to operate at. Too often it's a reactive, something's stopped, something's broken, something's leaking. That's not maintenance, that's service and repair work, you know. So maintenance should be really focused on that. And we can use more up-to-date technology to monitor performance, monitor whether plant is slipping away from its operational parameters, and when intervention of some degree needs to be taken. Just going into a summer, a really obvious thing is go and clean all your condensers, because actually in spring you get all the little seeds and everything coming off all the plants. The condensers act as great air scrubbers. Condensers get fouled up and you go straight into the middle of the time of year when you need them to operate as most efficiently as possible, and they're clogged of dirt and mess and goodness knows what. You know, it's just little things like that to keep an eye on it. But then if you take a further step back, yeah, and I think this is where things like AI will take a greater involvement in, is actually on, you know, real-time monitoring of performance to ensure that it's operating as it should do, and taking the steps to maintain that. You know, we've taken steps in our business to implement that type of technology. And what we can see is that if you go to an existing system, it's pretty quickly picking up items that can be addressed to improve efficiencies, ranging from 10 to 20, 30, 40, 50%, depending. But people get used to the way the plant operates, not thinking, is it operating effectively and efficiently as it was designed to do? But actually taking that step back on a regular basis, and real-time monitoring is possible now. And through development of things like AI, I'm sure will become more and more involved in this type of work moving forwards to ensure that we keep it as it should be. Because I think what we're seeing is that if you go up to piece of equipment now, is it actually operating as it should do? In many cases, not. It's outside of those parameters, and just returning it is relatively straightforward to do. A little bit of recommissioning, which is what we were mentioning there, you know, is some recommissioning required, and some incentivization of that type of technology would be hugely beneficial, because as Brian rightly says, the big energy user within our industry is the existing equipment. We're topping it up with new stuff all the time, but there's this huge amount of existing equipment that's operating, and that needs to be operating effectively to really to drive down the energy consumption of our industry.
What I'm hearing from those kind of discussions is really that you can't separate the climate issues from energy efficiency. Are all the solutions just make the system more efficient? Is there anything else that we should be doing? Should we be changing the design standard? Should we be knocking on the EN378 and saying, no, you've got to change everything? Should we be talking to manufacturers and asking them what changes are they making? Or is efficiency going to get us there?
I think that standards could be revised to have more of a forward-thinking approach to them rather than a looking backwards approach. Because it's clear we do have guidance notes and standards that dictate that we should follow a maximum design ambient and should consider as a designer what that maximum ambient temperature will be for the life of that product. But often it is past tense. It is considering what's happened in the past X number of years. And I think that actually highlighting the need to try and design for that uncertainty is a good opportunity. It's always difficult to predict exactly what ambient temperature rise we're going to have through the life of the product, but some effort towards that rather than none is likely to be beneficial.
And I guess it's also hard to predict how systems are going to perform, whereas at least if you look backward, you can see how they performed over that given time. Otherwise, you're just going to be looking at manufacturers' data and hoping that they perform to the way they said they would. So I can understand the forward-looking standards is quite a challenging.
It is. Yeah, absolutely is.
So I'm going to throw in a little question for you as we close. What do you think the Institute or the industry and the wider bodies in the Institute should be doing about this issue? So we're doing lots on energy efficiency. We've got our Beyond Refrigeration program. We're doing some research into different sectors with DESNZ. So there's lots going on. But if you look at what we're being told is that temperatures are already rising 1.2 degrees. The buildings are not designed to withstand 13-day heat waves, which we can expect. And the wetter winters and the flooding and the less stable temperatures. What can we do within the Institute and the industry just to help people start taking these things into account, start collaborating, start looking at standards, start looking at maintenance? How should we tackle it?
Okay, it's tricky, and I don't want it to sound completely complacent, but in many ways, I feel that we need to carry on with exactly what we are doing now within the Institute, continue to raise awareness, continue to engage with government and policymakers, continue to engage and inform engineers at all levels about the challenges that we are facing, and perhaps more importantly, continue to promote the industry to the younger generation through the STEM work that we're doing.
Thank you, Chris. Rob?
I think taking the report that we've just been discussing, distilling that down, and then looking at, well, where can we work with others? Where can we look to work with those setting regulations? You know, the eco design is one that stands out for me. You know, we design on 35. Can we get that? Can we work with the right people to get that pushed up to 40? Can we provide guidance on dealing with these higher ambients to support technicians in the field who are out there cleaning the condensers and setting it up to run at a 40 degree ambient on the hottest days, and continuing, as Chris said, with the good work that we're doing, working with alongside different fields as well, as we've spoken about already today, the wider construction industry, the architects, the construction companies, the people that are providing insulated boxes, all that side of all those different disciplines, so that we're not just in our refrigeration silo, and that we're able to affect the design of a building at the very outset, rather than just coming along to provide the cooling when it's all been decided.
Thank you. And then Brian.
Designed to use less capacity and less energy, because the grid that's trying to support these systems is not going to get any bigger. The grid's going through transition from fossil fuel to renewables, but ultimately the message is that it's not going to get any bigger than it currently is. So what we're plugging into that grid needs to be, has to be more efficient and has to be lower capacity. And we're going to have to think about how we go about doing that. The other thing is helping the user understand that their short-term decisions, their short-term investment decisions, will have significant long-term impacts on their businesses if they keep thinking about it in terms of short timescales, short-term investment. So I think what can we do is help bring that to life for the user of equipment. What does that short-term decision look like and long-term impact on their organization, which obviously has an impact on the environment at the same time, but bring it to life for them. But we mustn't forget capacity and energy on the grid that currently exists. We're plugging everything into the grid. We're plugging cars in, we're plugging heating in. Everything's getting plugged into the grid. It's only of a certain size. So we have to get energy efficiency and capacity down.
Thank you very much. Lots of really useful points to take forward on that. So we'll definitely be passing those on to our technical committee and others to think about how we can work and through other organizations, the institutes linked into people who are more on the construction, on the food side, on the building services side. So I would remind people about the IMEC-E report. I'll put a link in the podcast description where you can download that. There are lots of different things happening, lots of people really moving on this issue now. And the Institute hopes to have a conference in November where the report authors will come along and talk a little bit more about it. And we will pick up on some of these issues again and try to see how we're progressing to act quickly to make the kind of changes that you have been recommending that need to be made. Does anyone have any other closing remark?
My only last thought, which I think it was Rob, possibly Chris had also touched on as well, is the standards is one thing, but regulation is another. And the bringing together of regulation. So you have F-gas regulation on one side, eco-design regulation on the other. And when you have these conversations, it's they're taking care of that rather than we're taking care of that. So regulation, at the end of the day, all sits in one place from a government perspective. And how are those two entities talking together to make sure that the regulations align with each other? Because I fear that they're not aligned, that they're pushing and pulling in different directions, would be my last thought.
That may be something that we can share with the House of Commons Environmental Audit Committee. I'm sure they'll be interested. It's one of their questions about how is government working and how are they supporting us. Thank you all for your time spent looking and thinking about this and sharing your knowledge and expertise. It's not going to go away, is it? We are going to have these discussions again and again in different formats, and it's really important that we do and that we keep evolving how these issues are being addressed. So thank you very much again.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone.
Was the tip of the iceberg from the Institute of Refrigeration, and I'm Miriam Rodway. We hope you're enjoying our podcasts. Please like and share and follow the podcast and join us on the next edition. Thank you.